welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Sometimes people ask me what this show is about. And, you know, I mentioned kind of some of the spiritual topics and talk about, religious questions, maybe the nature of consciousness, a little bit of neuroscience. But technology has always been an important theme for me as a way to almost get into some of these other topics. I mean, going back to the early 90s, I was very much marked by the confluence of certain, you could think of them as California or Bay Area interests in expanding consciousness and the experimental edges of the mind, and the way that some of those ideas and practices got mixed up in all sorts of curious ways with the digital technology, with virtual reality, the emerging sense of the internet. And indeed, it's sort of no accident to me that both Apple and Google can have that their founders have these traces or tendrils that kind of weave through in this outback of consciousness exploration and a kind of exuberant embrace of the possibilities of the mind, even as they, you know, transform world economy and the very nature of communication, because there's always something very special and very curious about communication. How is it that we know things? How is it that we perceive things? How is it that we understand, particularly when we get to the margins of experience, those areas we don't encounter on an everyday basis? And of course, technology, media, from the book to the radio to television to personal computer, and now this exploding range of interactive devices and mobile computing, that all of these technological infrastructures, you know, shape and inform and mark our most intimate sense of ourselves and our relationship to the world, sometimes to the good, sometimes to the ill, sometimes to just pushing things into a new space of novelty where we don't know what's going on. And in some sense, we're involved in a massive experiment upon ourselves that is being blazed by both, capitalist raiders and who want to manage the mind share of the future, and the exploding space of possibilities that have been introduced by digital technology. So we're going to be surfing that edge today with our guest, Andrew Stone, who is a legendary independent software developer for, started off with the NEX, but a Mac head all the way back, and is now built quite a name for himself in the world of mobile computing apps, and has a very interesting history indeed. So I'll be looking forward to talking about these issues of consciousness and technological innovation in just a moment. But of course, we'll bring on our co-host here, Maja Daou, calling from Los Angeles, the most technological city on the planet. Well, but you're not that technological.
Dude, I don't even have an iPhone.
I know. I feel bad kind of having this conversation. You know, I've been like writing about technoculture for over 20 years, but I don't have a smartphone. You know, I just like...
I have like a Fisher... My phone, I think, is like made by Fisher Price.
Yeah, I call mine a dumb phone. You know, people try to do things, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I have a dumb phone. You know, and
that's awesome.
You know, the shift will happen, but at the moment, it's...
I like to keep my telepathic abilities strong, so I don't like relying on the technology.
Well, there is a kind of, you know, this sort of weird sense of stepping closer and closer to something like functional telepathy.
Yeah.
It's a very peculiar process because on the one hand, it's like utterly magical. I mean, if people 100 years ago could see the way we communicate, it would just look crazy and marvelous and unbelievable. And we do those things, and yet at the same time, we're just like, I got to buy the groceries, and oh no, I have to post that thing, and da, 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 and it's just sort of normal. Mm-hmm. But it's not normal.
It's totally weird.
You know, it's a very strange experience. And of course, there's the whole conversation about the way it's changing you know, social space, just like, you know, all these areas are now these areas of kind of boredom or sort of, you know, frozen time are now opportunities to interact, like waiting in line or, you know, the public transportation and all these things. It's a very, it really has changed remarkably how we feel in these kind of in-between public spaces that are now become a site for work and play in that domain.
Yeah, you can totally go on the dating site while you're buying your toilet paper and hook up a date for the evening.
That's a good analogy. Well, with that marvelous juxtaposition, we'll bring Andrew Stone onto the call. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure, Eric.
And you're calling from lovely Albuquerque, correct?
That's it, down here on the farm in the middle of the town.
I got to say, man, I had the opportunity to visit Andrew's place this summer, and it's a really great spread. It's right in the urban area, but it feels like a hippie farm off in the edges of town, and you have this marvelous tower and wonderful looking veggies and chickens and all that. It's not the kind of place you would associate with full on edge riding software development, but it's a nice contrast you seem to have been riding for throughout your whole life, really.
Well, yeah, I think it was 25 years ago this weekend that HyperCard was released for the Macintosh, and that was the first time that a development environment was created for regular people. That was going to be, it turned out that the Mac was amazingly easy to use, but it was almost impossible to program originally. And so HyperCard was like Apple's first effort to let's create, it really turns out that it's sort of the father of the internet, because you created a stack of cards, so that would be like web pages really linked together, and they had, you know, these wonderful hyperlink things. That was the word hyper, everything was hyper back then. And but that was a way that regular people, i.e. non-programming types, were getting sucked into the possibility of the Mac. And for me, that was my entree before I really decided that was my full-on thing to do.
Right, and you'd studied architecture and design and were
right.
in organic farming and all this other stuff.
Yeah, it's in 1974, I moved out to New Mexico. I'd been living in South America for a couple years. I'm a young kid, I'm like 13 in 1969, so I'm too young to really go to the dead show, but I'm reading Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley and On the Road by Kerouac, and I'm like, you know, high school is getting a little boring. What if I could just, okay, I'm doing it. So a friend of mine and I went down to Mexico. He had to go home. He was not going to go to South America, but I had to go. It was like one of those things. And I spent basically a year and a half, you know, traveling, learning Spanish, you know, learning Quechua, hanging out with the Indians in Peru and Ecuador. And so that was sort of how I decided that New Mexico was the place to emigrate from the Rust Belt where I grew up to New Mexico. And I ended up in 74 out here. So anyway, this is now where the counterculture has, you know, left San Francisco, gone to the various hog farms, like there was one in northern New Mexico. And, you know, the hippies are, you know, going back to the earth in New Mexico. I wanted to be as much a part of that as I could. So that's sort of where the architecture thing came in, because then we were just beginning to understand solar architecture, passive solar design. And that was the thing back then. So,
and it's gone on to really, you know, influence New Mexico. It's funny about New Mexico is New Mexico is kind of like the hidden story of the counterculture, because when people reflect back on the 60s and the 70s and they think about, you know, of course, California and what happened in New York and upstate New York and, you know, certain events that happened.
They had better press.
And they don't really quite remember how much happened in New Mexico, and still how much of the shape of New Mexico, the architecture of New Mexico, particularly in northern New Mexico, is influenced by the very, you know, culture that you were helping to foment.
And that everyone, it was sort of like, the same pull that people must have felt to work on the atomic bomb in the 40s and 50s. It's like, this is the challenge. You know, consciousness is the nut that we're going to crack in our lifetimes. And, you know, we start by eating a peach, and then it keeps going from there, practically.
Yeah, and so that totally makes sense. So HyperCard, it opens up this whole space of development. I think that's another thing that we kind of forget, you know, especially now when so many things are mediated through the internet and through programming environments, is that the creativity and the openness and the diversity and the speed with which the digital media space developed had a lot to do with the way that development happened. And that's something I think we don't necessarily think about so much, especially on the outside, people who are not actually working with that. So what was it about that environment from HyperCard and then moving on to the next computer, you know, the Steve Jobs's?
Right. So, like, it's like the late 80s, and I'm like, going, where did all the heads go? Where are all the freaks? And so, you know, that was right when, you know, the bulletin boards were coming up and also the Usenet groups. And so, like, these people are, like, figuring out about the Internet before Al Gore even knows it's invented yet. And there are these little communities like CompSys Mac HyperCard, and actually, they're exactly Google Groups and stuff. I mean, it's like some things are never really new. They're just kind of rebranded. But so here you find everybody in the world who's interested in your one little thing. And so this really became the first time when people who had interest in the same area could, like, work together remotely. And that's the cool part, because a lot of people who are into tech and, you know, your basic Asperger model guy, you know, fixates on things, you know, totally gets into it. Maybe not perfect with other people and stuff. So the whole idea of telecommuting is perfect, because there's less of that. You know, sometimes there's a lot of awkwardness in, you know, the meeting, the M-E-A-T of people, when it's the bodies and not just the, you know, the disembodied telephone or the disembodied internet and stuff like that. So it turned out that this was a strength for people, that they could be able to be in the comfort of their home or their farm or whatever and be working together with other programmers. And this was really the advent of this notion called abstract data types, which was the father concept to object-oriented programming, which now we just all use. And, you know, you just drop in a JavaScript and now you have, you know, your website's hooked up to a database. Well, you know, all that, the complexity of all that has been hidden in the fact that, you know, people have been standing on giant shoulders over and over ever since basically Alan Turing. And, you know, and I've been climbing on their shoulders and jumping up and go, look at me, look at me. And then somebody climbs on my head, and, you know, it's really fun.
Yeah, I think what I'm getting is, again, for, you know, people who don't have experience with these environments, is that what programming is in the zone that you're talking about, that becomes object-oriented, these kinds of developing environments, is that you can sort of use lots of elements that have already been developed, that if you looked underneath the hood, you know, they're immensely complicated. But once they're sort of working, you can just sort of treat them as a process or an object that you plug into something else that you're
exactly.
That you're doing.
So these heavy lifters are doing this incredible work. Right now, the world is transformed by the phenomena of Stack Overflow, which is where programmers show off their knowledge by answering everybody's questions, and then it's peer-reviewed, so the best, rightest answer filters up. And so anybody doing, you know, app store development now can basically have access to a million engineers' experience. So that's what we're sharing. And then on GitHub, you know, and Git as a tool, and GitHub in particular, where a lot of open-source sharing is, you can basically, it's like walking into a hardware store and pulling off these really nice, you know, pieces of equipment that you can then, you know, hook together and make something brand new, but without having to perhaps do the kind of heavy lifting you're not really capable of doing, because it's not your domain of expertise.
Well, one question about that culture is that, you know, in the 90s, especially when there was so much, this real sense, this kind of massing awareness of the transformation that was coming forward, and there was a lot of attention to these open source ideas, both in a political and just in a technological sense. You know, so much stuff has happened since then. So many people have made money in so many different kinds of ways, and are seeking to increase that. Even as the opportunities have exploded in all sorts of directions in terms of all the places that digital computers touch our lives.
How much is that
sense of the open source, that sense of the engineers who are going to help you out with more information,
right?
Because it's almost a kind of status economy of doing that. Are things still
Now it's moved into that so full-time that in a lot of ways big companies will only hire you for a project. And so people are on projects. And the project as a model, as an organizing model, sometimes is really better than the corporation as the organizing principle, because people will get pulled together because of their interests. And so it was nascent in the early 90s, and here's what's going on. Steve Jobs, so it's 1989, the next computer has been announced after 3 years of, him being hidden away. And, it's 88. It's 88, and they're in late 88, and they're going from college to college. They think because they've managed to merge a Mac with Unix, with the solid iron of Unix. That was like, Steve never wanted to see the bomb again, if you know what I mean, the little bomb that used to come up on the Mac when it would crash, the blue screen of death. But the third thing that it was not only the Mac and the Unix, it was the laser writer, because the whole display model was the same that was being used to generate laser printed documents, but right on the screen. So what was called display PostScript. And what's so interesting about that is that we had this little language that was chosen to do the UI development in, called Objective-C. And what is odd is that it is the most commercially used language per number of devices on the planet right now. And yet, it was just this little boutique-y, object-oriented language that kind of came out of Park, Xerox Park. And yet, it became the actual tool that allowed little people like me to hook in with all the other guys and have our collective work be something that is way more than the sum of its parts.
So you worked with Steve Jobs at the Next, and it's been really interesting this last... Since he died, watching the sort of the world process the meaning of his life, and I was particularly interested, of course, in that people had to engage some of the California aspects of his existence, and sort of have to go, well, you got to acknowledge that he thought LSD was one of the best things and best experiences of his life, and he went to India and he was a Buddhist, and so all these very not the norm aspects of his own personal life came up. But what's really been part of the sort of dialogue, of course, almost as a way to not pay attention to his debt to Whole Earth Review and a kind of Bay Area way of thinking about systems that is influenced by Buddhism and psychedelics and things like that. Instead, it's been this conversation about, all right, he was an asshole. Is this how you get things done? And all these business. Do I emulate him and be a jerk to my employees, or do I try to improve on the model? And that's really
right.
Been the kind of dominant story. How do you see?
Well, I have this luxury of 23 years of reflection on it. Right after I went to the Next camp, which you have to do, I started writing this cool type styling program. I showed it to him. He loved it. And he goes, "You have to write the database for the Next." And so I look over at my partner, and she's like, "And then we said, okay, we'll do it as long as it has multimedia and, you know, sounds and pictures and stuff. And we did. And that was what was so interesting and critical to understanding Steve is that he is this success in America. He leaves because the corporate raiders come in from PepsiCo, and now Apple is going to get all corporate. And he's going to kill and chop away any of his counterculture stuff. Anyway, so he leaves that, but he did want to redefine himself. He was really trying to distance all that crazy talk 70s stuff where, you know, the story at Apple is, you know, it was like they only wanted to know if you had drugs to see whether or not you were sharing them. And so he was trying, in a way, it was a very dark time, including even the Black Next and whatever. And then the story of how it's originally pitched for academia. And, you know, that's who the first people who got on board were all about, the ideas, the philosophy, the connection, this new thing. We were setting up our next machines as UUCP nodes. So my friend John Barlow up there in Pinedale, Wyoming had one, and I had one down here. And, you know, the internet mail is running on all of our little cubes. And so Steve, at this time, is trying to make, he has this vision, he's totally solid. And as far as his personality and stuff, I mean, it's like I think people in my family have Asperger's, so I'm really, really used to working with very smart people who know they're right, and they can't tolerate fools, and I kind of get that. And they used to, you know, Barlow would always talk about how Bud Tribble was Steve's human interface. In other words, you know, they'd go in a meeting, you know, Steve would kind of ram them, you know, this and that and the other, you know, and the guy moved so fast. So he leaves, everybody's looking around what happened, and then Bud would be left there explaining what Steve really meant, and, you know. But I liked, first of all, I felt like as Steve tried to clean up his act and get more corporate, and as the market went from, it was going to be academia, but they didn't buy it, it was too expensive, then they went on to, eventually they were selling to the NSA, the CIA, and big Wall Street firms, because that's where the money was. And so that maybe caused Steve to have like this effort to like clean up, get all the Armani, the black look, everybody's, you know, it's all clean and it's not hippie. However, I felt like, but wait a minute, I'm not going to change my whole, you know, spiritual adventure just to fit into this corporate. I'm going to bring this along with the ride because I know that this is the core, the heart of what and why people care about following Steve's vision. And that was because of kind of how it had grown out of his hanging out with Ram Dass's guru and, you know, things like that. And so the bigger tale, the woven tale. And basically, it's 1990. I'm at SIGGRAPH. And I look up on the stage, and there's, you know, Tim Leary, Esther Dyson, Jaron Lanier. You know, they're all, you know, all the big names in alternative, not alternative, but in virtual reality. And somebody I hadn't really known was up there, John Perry Barlow. And so they're all, you know, we hear what they have to say, and Barlow goes, you know, he just stands up and he goes, look, I don't know what you think, but, you know, you have these machines that maybe for a couple million dollars you can kind of see something interesting, when for just $2 or $3 you can get a hit of acid and do the same thing. And that was like one of the first times I'd heard in public people being honest and open about psychedelics. And I think that was really interesting because a couple months later, I get a call. It's John Barlow. He's working for Next World magazine, and he wants to interview me. And I go, oh, John Perry Barlow? And his ears, you know, and after that, we were just like, you know, we were the Rocky Mountain Next users, basically. But I think we got the vision, but we also kind of took on the role of, okay, Steve, you can wear the Armani suits and everything, but the people who are going to be building this world are going to be the same old cyberpunk types who have been, you know, influenced by Philip K. Dick since the 70s and are, you know, the whole thing. And
well, you guys had a rave, right? That's it.
We started in 1992. We rented the Palace of Fine Arts, and we basically, I had some friends in the, you know, in the San Fran gay community who were totally, I mean, it was sort of like they did their whole hippie thing in the early 90s. And so they could, you know, hook us up with all the cool projectors and things. And we basically turned that place into an amazing scene. And that was the first one. We did a couple. We did one each year until they no longer sold Next machines. And so that's the weird part about it, is we were basically taking on kind of a role as the, I don't know if you want to, it's just some sort of shamanic role where it's not just about money, you know, and it's going to be about
the community.
And so
where do you see that now? I mean, you were at the heart of those crisscrossing lines of expanding consciousness, the sort of, you know, hippie re-architect society, the spirit and its relationship.
It's like 20 year. It has this amazing 20 year periodicity, because it was like in the early 70s when the counterculture was going mainstream nationwide, all the experimentations happening then, again in the early 90s, and again now. Except for now, the kids are like, oh, we're microdosing, you know, and then they're using, you know, advanced pharmaceuticals that I don't even know. You know, I mean, I barely heard of. And then their attitudes towards cannabis and things, I mean, at least in the Bay Area, this is revolutionary. And the whole idea is to free the mind so that you can come up with all these fantastic, great ideas. Now, I have to say, I'm a yogic practitioner, and that's my main way of trying to get the high that we all love so much, the unity feeling.
Well, I'm curious, how does yoga help you, like, work? I mean, you're clearly coming, you have one of those minds. You have one of those, like, obsessive, brilliant, crazy, you know, minds that's going to grab onto stuff, and it's probably not the easiest thing for you to interface with all the stuff in the world. I mean, you're a very successful person. You have a lot of interesting things you've developed in your life. I'm curious how much spiritual practice helps you kind of, you know, with your programming mind, with the mind that is going to obsess and code all night long and have that kind of obsessive fascination.
It's the only thing that allows it to continue day after day. It's the thing that gives it the, for me, and I think for a lot of people too, I go like this. I go, if I skip my hour of yoga, then, you know what, I won't get enough done in that hour to make up for how much I can get done once I'm relaxed and once I'm really focused. Because they're, especially in software, there are rat holes everywhere. You know, a lot of times you'll be code whispering, kind of figuring out, oh, it must be this, and you'll be way off. And so there's a lot of rabbit holes to go down. And then so I think that the weird thing is that the altered states that we seek, how do we bring them into our daily existence? Just like when I'm looking over at you and looking at your eyes and seeing the light in your eyes, and all of a sudden I'm re-experiencing how I'm configured as an individual, because it's no longer just, it's weird, but I try to let myself have these seconds in the day where I'm no longer thinking or processing, I'm just opening up to it. And in a way that makes it just so much easier to be with people too, if you don't have all these agendas and stuff. So I think that part of it is the muses are there, they'll work through you, but you do have to keep your hardware tuned or something like that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting practice, is how to learn how to allow those moments to exist in the day. I mean, I think one of the problems that happens when we have some kind of explicit spiritual practice that we recognize balances us out or reminds us of these deeper currents in life and nature. But sometimes because we have our hour or half an hour, whatever, a day, that we go, okay, I took care of it, and now I'll just, you know, get completely absorbed in the pinball game of ordinary life. And just to be able to have these, I mean, it sounds like such a small thing, but it's not a small thing to have those moments where you can recognize that all I need to do is sit down here for a moment or really catch that person's eye and let it rest for a moment.
Right.
And those spaces can open up.
I tell people my goal is not to become a visionary, but to become a listenary.
That's beautiful. Well, we have to take a break right now. This is a fascinating conversation. We're talking with Andrew Stone here on Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maj Daou, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maj Daou here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Andrew Stone about computer-y types of things. And Andrew, I was curious. So you mentioned the community that arose within the programmers. And I mean, I think a lot of people have this idea that computer programmers are all very solitary, hermity types of dorky dudes that sit around by themselves for hours and then.
The dorky dude part is right, though.
But it's fascinating to me, especially with all this hyper-business going on and with some of the psychedelic use, the contingency and coherency of consciousness of computer programmers that kind of arises within these groups. Like even in the Usenet groups, or that there's like this cloud in Computer Town, you know, up in cyberspace, where all the computer programmers' minds are like meeting together and doing stuff together, and then it amalgamates in computer land, like resulting in this program that then builds computer land bigger. So if you look at those kind of implications, I was just curious if you personally ever experienced a kind of group consciousness event while you were on one of those programming communities that had like a big repercussion.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I call it the object Satori. It's like the first time you get that you are just this little tiny thing, but it's okay because you're part of this huge thing. And sometimes that's the biggest way we can be. Not, you know, it's not about us. And that's the thing about Steve. Was it really wasn't about him or his, you know, lack of personal skills or whatever. It was about the fact that, man, he knew what cool was. He was helping these dorky dudes for the first time have a real sense of cool. And I think that's, you know, and I would really credit people like Neal Stephenson and William Gibson, and of course back to Philip K. Dick, really, of bringing the cool to the cyborg, cybernetic, cyberdelic kind of guy that I think really is how we imagined ourselves, and the whole possibilities. It was like we'd already taken the acid. Now we wanted the computers to take the acid.
Mm.
And I have this email from Terrence McKenna and our friend Soul Jerky, Spiros Antonopoulos, and we were discussing how it would be possible to make computer programs that would replicate or help people understand the DMT experience. And it's kind of cool. It took about 11 years later. Some technology got developed at Apple, by the way, if you don't know this part, in 96, Apple buys Next for $400 million, but something odd happened on the way to the bank, which was simply that Steve installed himself as CEO and all of his buddies from Next as vice presidents at Apple. So somebody asked me, Andrew, what does this mean for you? I go, I think it means I got a raise. And so now all these guys are, now we have this,
you know,
this
power.
Yeah, it's all of a sudden, now it's going to be like real people are going to be able to use our software. Because it turned out that the Next, it got very dark. And this was something that I think is part of the story, is that he tried to sell it to here. He tries to sell it there. It's not working. And so when things fail, people are being blamed. People are being fired. And this is how I explain how to be an Indian. Indy is somebody who is very much in the circuit of everything, but he's just far enough away from where the thrashing goes on that flying objects don't hit him. And that's how I was able to maintain for all this time, sort of relationship with Apple, where I have my sovereignty and my dignity as an indie. Yet, you know, if they need something, they'll say, Andrew, you've got to, you know, write this up. And I'm like, I'm on it. I can do it. And so it's sort of a feudal system where you have a little city-state outside the big city-state or something. And yet, what's giving you the power to do that is your other little buddies who are indies, too. And something that was not even thought about then, because remember, the software industry back then was things were shrink-wrapped. They cost $500 for stuff that already had bugs in it, and they knew it had bugs in it. And that, so we took it from this brick-and-mortar thing, and in 1990, we started shipping our software online where anybody could download it, and they would have to buy the key if they liked it so they could demo it. And this freemium idea, I mean, it's totally the only way to go now, but like back then, nobody knew. I mean, there was no such thing as non-shrunk-wrap software. And so back then, the only people that could, you know, need apply were the companies that were big enough to do all that. And that's where the next came in to kind of destroy all that, because the internet is being created. We're all linked together. We're just riding this amazing high of feeling like this is the future. So we got in so early that we were able to have success right away with our software. And so that was one thing that prompted me to stay behind the effort. But one by one, as it seemed not going anywhere, people would drop off, and they would always write some nasty thing on the internet, which would forever haunt them, that, you know, they had given up the vision, the journey. And
well, what happened to some of your friends that did that? Like, what happened to them in their lives?
Well, another group of young guys who got in real early, the Lighthouse guys, they ended up, like, selling off to Sun Microsystems, and then their guy later became the CEO of Sun. And so some of them, you know, so many of my friends are either in Apple or right around Apple. And the veil between Apple, inside and outside, that was one of my first tweets after Steve left the second time, which was basically that, you know, the walls, the veil between this world, between Apple inside and outside, are so thin. And it's because we're working on one, you know, kind of massive project, or I feel like people feel like they are plugged in to human evolution or the evolution of consciousness. And, you know, and our little pathetic tools that we have keep getting better, but they definitely are connecting us. And like the Twitter thing, I just did as a lark.
Yeah, well, talk a little bit about the things that you've done more recently, you know, as part of, you know, stone.com, where you go and you're developing apps as this independent developer. You're not part of some larger, you know, corporate kind of structure, and you got in there right away with your Twitter app and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you're like, you know, trying to move into this new space that's exploding with all of these mobile devices and apps and that kind of zone. So you sort of carried forward that spirit that you had with the Next and with, you know, the Macintosh back in the day, now into this, you know, this mobile app zone. What's that? How does that carry on the same sort of spirit?
Well, what's so odd is that each time we get these new challenges and stuff, it's like the good old days all over again. And so, I mean, I immediately developed, like, a couple really intense computer science-type programs, you know, for, like, drawing and doing audio and blogging and stuff like that. And they did all right, but just on a lark, I said, oh, I have to build a Twitter client. I'd heard that story about the guy in Egypt who gets put in jail, tweets out help, and then his friends come and save him. And so I'm like, that is so cool. I'm going to build a Twitter client that has a button, an emergency button. Now, that turned out to be a really stupid idea. And by version, you know, by the third version, that thing was gone, that button. But what had become apparent was people were finding that Twitter was really interesting when you could upload pictures and upload audio and upload video and a bunch of other features that Twitilator, our project, brought to the platform first. So I got to once again participate in the design and the way it's going to go down in my own little indie way, because there's other indies doing other clients, and we're all kind of looking at each other's cool features, trying to top each other. And so really it was just like Twitterific and Twitilator and Tweety, you know, and a few other ones that were like creating the movement behind the Twitter experience. It's like, who wants to sit on a computer and write 140 characters? Like, what's the purpose of that? So, but when you're in line at the bank, or, you know, like you say about that moment, the interstitial moments that were used to be waiting, now we're tweeting, advice to some of the candidates, tweet less and maybe vet those tweets in the cold light of day. But
Well, let's talk about Twitter a little bit, since you've spent a lot of time thinking about it and helping to sort of foment it. And from the kind of, you know, evolution of consciousness perspective, not from just, oh, it's a new app and it's creating a certain kind of social space.
Right, and how it differed very much from, it was the whole discoverability thing, where I almost want to call it promiscuousness, because you are reaching out. And unlike Facebook, where it's all sort of a social graph that's so usable by the NSA, thank you very much, people. You do your work. You do our work for us. And, you know, there's that. And then there's this other thing, which is like, what are the edges? What are people thinking? And so, like, as I, you know, started developing the program, one thing I knew I needed was a wide stream of tweets. So, like, when people followed me from Japan, I'd follow them back. And then, so, you know, and then, of course, I immediately had to add translate to the Twitter client, because what was it they were saying? And so Twitter turned out to be this amazing mashup where you're taking, oh, somebody made a tweet shortening service, and somebody has a place if your tweet gets too long, and then different image services. And so our apps were being made to mash up on top of 10 or 15 cool services. And it's all being done by people in garages, which gets back to me about the ultimate gift that Steve gave us. And it's not really the technology so much as it's the personal freedom to actually be in your garage. And now you and this other guy are the Woz, except there's a million of you, and you can now build your apps. And there's no social stigma of apps being written by one or two people. That's okay now. Back then, it was like IBM. There was a whole army of people writing the software. But that turns out to be not a very good idea.
And what do you think about Twitter as a phenomenon in terms of how it moves in through people's lives, how it changes the way they communicate? I find it very interesting, because I'm not on Facebook. And part of the reason is because not just the sort of political aspects of how your information is collected and all of the kind of spooky stuff, but I also just don't find it very interesting, even against my own sort of, I guess I should be trying to
better
promote
interest.
Myself all the time. I'm not that interested in like maintaining a kind of space,
a Pollyanna view of your life.
Exactly,
but
Twitter is really amusing.
The new disorder I read about in the New York Times, where people stay up at night and are like shamed by the fact that their friends are just having these great lives. And I go like, you know what? Those people only post when they're feeling good. And so it really skews it. And
yeah,
it's like, oh, well. I mean, you know. But the thing about the Twitter is, with the search tags and stuff, it's like your real-time news feed breaking before anybody sees it kind of thing. And it's also a way to experience the thoughts of other people who you normally wouldn't. You've already self-selected out of your life, and so you've limited and narrowed your life, and so you don't really get the guns and ammo perspective, because you don't know these people. And you don't. In fact, you've created a way to like kind of cut them out of your life, and then so you're like, I can't believe Missouri says that guy's great or whatever, and it's like, well, you really need to have a wider tweet stream or something.
Well, but that's a very interesting component of it as well, both with Facebook and Twitter, because you can moderate the feed streams, right? So
exactly.
It becomes this consciously chosen view of reality, right? Like some dudes, they just want, like, all the Playboy models tweets or like whatever. Like, you know, there's some people whose streams are consciously edited to only have like Paris Hilton updates and stuff like this. So there is that kind of, that works on good sides, but also not so good sides, and that people's realities are being formulated by these streams of consciousness that they're choosing to put in. And while it can be very expanding, I think the reality for a lot of people is that it's really just kind of horrifyingly pigeonholing.
Self-limiting.
Yeah.
And Twitter is going to at least take you a little further away from that than Facebook, but it could have the same phenomena. And then, you know, basically we are going to bore ourselves with this, and we're going to have to come up with the next cool thing to do. And it may be the, for me, it's like I started a coffee clutch for programmers in Albuquerque, Coco Conspiracy, about 4 years ago, because I realized, you know, there's something to that whole really just being with people, even if you're just sitting around all on your Macs and iPhones programming and not even talking to each other. Sometimes you just got to get together. And I've noticed that it's become more and more social and less about work, because obviously that's this critical need that's going unmet, or that we're going to have to create structures for to in our digital lifestyles.
Well, I want to just bring in another, you know, element that we haven't talked about too much, is that you mentioned it earlier. You know, you were a participant in Rick Strassman's famous and notorious series of DMT experiments in Albuquerque, and you talked earlier a little bit about, you know, how you could use computers to model that experience and things like that. How much have you drawn from, like, really that deep, very intense, very otherworldly kind of experience in terms of your sense, intuitive, intellectual, of what we're doing to ourselves on a large scale with all this intense mediation? Is there some kind of relationship there? How do those things link up in your own worldview?
Well, I think that when you, first of all, it's really interesting and fun to be able to talk about the psychedelics I was given by the U.S. government. And so that's always, it's always an interesting topic. And the Spirit Molecule movie, I just find it fascinating that even though the work began on it, like in 2006, that it had to wait until 2012, Terrence's favorite year, to actually come out. And then it's really fun to talk to all these younger kids, programmers and stuff, who are building the Facebook and Path and this and that and the other, and hear their experiences about this. And it's like, for me, the interesting difference between DMT and some of the more classic psychedelics is that the level of personal, it's as though the divine is actually personally, this is really personal. This is about your own thing. And so, unfortunately, it tends to create more questions than it answers. But that's okay. That's what you're going to come away with, learning that, yes, the paradox of reality, I guess I can live with that now. Maybe I don't need to seek absolutes. Maybe this sense of unknowing that is just around the corner all the time. Well, first of all, now you know that if you rip away reality, then you have this other reality. Well, how do people, you know, how do you continue your life realizing you may or may not even be on this plane of existence?
Well, what I'm getting from you is that, you know, I think sometimes people approach you know, spiritual experience and psychedelic experiences, if there's going, they're going to discover something, they're going to really find out something, they're going to uncover and get whatever it is, the connection with the world mind or the alien mushroom or their inner guru or whatever the sort of framework is. And what I'm hearing from you is that it actually, in some ways, it becomes a way of getting used to not knowing, getting used
and,
to...
And there's a lot of humbling with it, too. I mean, one of the most distinct things I remember are these entities are kind of smugly going, look who just woke up. It's like, okay, I'm sorry, but maybe I'll pay more attention now.
Well, it's true because those are things that have existed, like, you know. I mean, it's true. It's our perception.
Right.
Which grows, not the reality, right?
Right, exactly. It's like allowing ourselves to just take the time to perceive other things.
Yeah.
Use your body as a lightning rod. Feel where you're holding all that, and then just kind of let go. And, you know, whatever your practice is, it needs to be remembered every day. And that's the thing, that this whole thing is there's the big, you know, you kind of have the big realizations, and then you have the hard work to try and make it part and parcel of your existence.
What's your hard work right now?
For me, the hardest work is that I'm raising kids, you know, my daughter has special needs. She has CP, and she has like a brain like mine, but then she has some other challenges. And so it's like, you know, people go, oh, I'm going to go seek a teacher. And, you know, I chose what's called the householder path in yoga, which is, you know, you continue to have a job and you have a family, but you still do your practice. And then what comes to you are exactly the people that need to teach you the hard stuff. You know, it's like, you know, those lessons about humility, about what can and can't be done in a life, what is realistic, what isn't. And it was like the whole idea of the bad trip is the one that kind of ends up teaching you more about yourself, as opposed to, you know, it's all light and bliss. Well, it is, as long as you don't, you know, fall into the all the pit of dark.
So I'm curious too, as you go through and you get older and you're dealing, you know, all this stuff with family, and you have this, you know, a rich life, has it changed your enthusiasm for what's happening with technology? It doesn't sound like it has. And
no, I think I'm just so excited that my people are here now. It's like I feel like the 20-somethings, you know, already share my views on so many things and about the way we want to go about doing it and how we're going to do it together kind of thing. And it's about how it's a group effort and how the individual is clearly important because you will be called to do exactly what you're supposed to do. You know, the thing is, what happens is the more, if you travel the path, then you just, what gets stripped away is your own sort of idea about what it is that you're going to be doing or how you're going to be doing it. And then, it's kind of weird, but in other words, you know, it seems to me, if you really go on the path, then more mystery arises, not like, oh yeah, God, great guy. You know, you got to have lunch with him sometime, or her, really.
And so what's up next for you with technology? I know you don't want to talk about, you know, specific things that you're working on, but...
Well, it's amazing how many large companies have been trying to hire me lately. So I don't know. I want it to be something that's really cool and fun. And I think that the Twitter thing, we've already done that, and... You know, Twitter's kind of making a move to consolidate their own holdings or whatever. So it's kind of a nice time. It's the harvest, so this is a time to do a little less software and do a little more, put the pickles in the jars, can the peaches, you know. Just kind of be attentive to your life. That's sort of like the missing thing, that secret thing. It's like you have it all the time. It's just it was there the whole time, you didn't see it because, you know, you're tripping over what you want to do next or something. So I don't know, maybe just really being present would be a good thing for me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, too, when you think about how much technology helps and then also hinders that process. I mean, it's easy to see the way that it hinders it, kind of obstructing our, distracting ourselves from that opportunity for presence and inhabiting our lives. But at the same time, it's clear that all these ideas and all these practices continue to be a very important part of people's lives, even as they go forward with all this technology stuff. So it's an interesting paradox. You're right.
Yeah, it is. It's the typical problem of the Aquarian. He's rooted deeply in the past and in the future, and those are the things that make the most sense.
Yeah. Well, so, Andrew, we got to wrap it up here. I just want to thank you so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric.
And you can go check out more of Andrew's work at stone.com. From Majin Mead, all you out there, keep your minds open.